on the Voice of America.
Due to the global outbreak of the coronavirus, the Voice of America is taking every necessary precaution to safeguard its employees, so our broadcast will look a little different today and in the near future as we reduce our staffing at VOA headquarters here in Washington. We appreciate your staying with us on Straight Talk Africa.
Hello, you're welcome to Straight Talk Africa. Coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. I am Shaka Sali. Joining me is Tijan Muhammad Bande, the president of the 74th session of the United Nations General Assembly. Mr. President, I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much. I'm also very grateful that we're able to have this conversation. Thank you.
You're most welcome. And of course, as I said earlier, your reputation precedes you, so you really should not have any problems.
Thank you.
You are the master of the conversation we are about to have. Talk to us about what it is like to have the honor to be in your position for the last 1 year. How has it felt like?
Well, thank you very much indeed. I think you have put the correct words in view, the honor. Mm-hmm. It is indeed an honor to be selected by your peers, and they are my peers, to lead the assembly at the 74th session, being also having the honor of being the second Nigerian to hold the position in a space of 30 years. Now, this is on behalf of Africa as a candidate, but for the world. This is certainly an honor. Now, it's an honor to have colleagues say that for the following year, you should lead us in having conversations, agreements, and even disagreements relating to important matters of the world. And I think that is really what it is. And obviously, it started normally, 6 months regular meetings in the assembly and the negotiations that took place in person. But then all of a sudden, things changed. And 6 months into the new reality, we continued to work as an assembly. And so it is the honor that you talk about, not only to lead during more normal times, but also to work with 193 countries, representing countries north and south, east and west, to push the agenda of the United Nations. So this is what it is, that it is certainly an honor, and I'm grateful to have the opportunity to lead this conversation.
Talking about having the honor to be the second individual from Nigeria to hold that position, the first, of course, having been Brigadier General Joseph Garba. Any particular reason why Nigeria has been able to be honored twice, despite the fact that there are 54 African countries? What is the secret behind that?
I think the secret behind it, if it's a secret, is really not so much hidden. that the continent is really one unit. It is difficult to find, and I can tell you this, any representative of an African country that will not tell you at the same time that he is representing also Africa. So while in the normal rotation, it is the regions of the continent that take turns within 5-year periods to have the opportunity to provide a leader representing the continent at PGA. So even within this, there is an understanding that really this is not the kind of fight to the death. It's really a conversation among countries. And of course, it's relating to countries, but also relating to candidates. And this is it. So it's really because the continent of Africa has continued, even under difficult times, to really talk as one. We do have our differences, but nonetheless, it is difficult to find a country on the continent that doesn't have the strong sentiment that what we do for the world, but we also act for the continent. This is really, really the main reason why it was not an issue that a Nigerian candidate was found acceptable to the West Africa region and also to the African continent.
I see. Walk us, if you could, through a day in the life of Tijan Muhammad Bande, the president of the 74th session of the United Nations General Assembly. What time, for example, do you go to bed, and what time do you actually wake up?
Big question. Each day is unique in what it brings, obviously. But typically, you need to really be ready to get on with the business of the assembly from around 5:30, 6 in the morning, because you have to be prepared to go to work. There are a number of things you have to do. Looking at documents, looking at agreements and disagreements concerning a host of issues, some being pushed because they are important for one region of the continent or because they are important for one country of the world, be it small or large, because the assembly is an assembly of equals. No issue brought by any member state is small and must be addressed as an issue of the assembly. But of course, in the prioritization of what you do, obviously you are also guided by traditions and practices. And you are guided by the rules concerning rules of procedure, and some of these things are procedural, some are new, but whatever they are, you have to come to it with a sense of responsibility. There can be really different strong pulls one way or the other, but your task is to listen and listen very carefully. What exactly is it you can do to push toward agreement? Because really, our whole push is to see whether we can have consensus, not only consensus because of consensus, but that also retains substantive elements. You don't reach consensus just to say we have consensus, but that some issue has been advanced. And often there are disagreements that continue, but most of the issues really achieve consensus, or maybe a significant number. Some, of course, will require a vote, and then the assembly moves on. So typically, you have many things scheduled. Some things come. There are small meetings to consult and to strategize. Some will require meetings with groups. And this can go on until probably 8-9 in the evening. And you obviously will have to find space to think through how to plan the following day. How over the weekend, you have to have space over the weekend to plan the week ahead. And at times you do this when you're also traveling between countries. And that adds some other pressure. What things must you reschedule because they are important? And when you're away, the requirements of those inviting you, whether countries or of whether organizations, will be there. But still, the requirements of New York, because the office must move with you, must also constantly be under watch. Of course, you do this because you also have a lot of support from your office, but also from the secretariat. And many, many people are positive in trying to help you through this every day. So typically, it's long hours, but you don't carry the burden alone. You are assisted, but you have to, of course, take lead in taking decisions, because ultimately, good or bad, you own it.
Of course, there is a saying, if you break it, you own it.
Indeed.
Now, based on your experience, what would you say are some of the specific qualities that one needs to have in order to be a successful president of the UNGA?
Well, I would imagine that most qualities that we come to associate with leadership of organizations, at least civil organizations that I certainly know of, are needed to succeed in this office. But I will say the ability, well, first of all, knowledge. Because without knowledge, you will not even know which advice to take and which not to take. Mm-hmm. Of course, integrity, that you don't talk something that you do not mean. That you just have to have the integrity that colleagues, even when they disagree with you, will say, well, we disagree, but he's not an evil person. And because if there's no integrity, you can't bring the assembly together. And especially important in this context, because there are issues around which members have divergent, at times even deeply differing views. But still, they must see that what you say is really something that you believe in and is also within the rules. You also have to, obviously, in relation to knowledge and integrity, you really have to have patience. Sometimes you have a feeling that some delegation, one or two, can create really real difficulties, and you investigate to find the difficulties are brought not because of the issue at hand, but because of some other game that is not really at play, but which is likely to come into view in the relationship between that country and some other country that is seen as pushing one other agenda. So, but again, you just have to have patience, because delegations come representing countries. And at times, they also have to, a lot of times indeed, have to listen to capital. And even if they disagree with capital, they also have to give them time to also explain to the capital that, look, the dynamics here are this, and we will look out of step if we insist on this. And then some negotiation concerning, okay, given this, what flexibility is there? So certainly patience with this process, it looks cumbersome, but it is a necessary cumbersomeness in a way, because nobody will just decree to the assembly. You just have to try to carry all delegations along. At times, not all, but at least a substantial number, so that decisions or resolutions have legitimacy. And if you are pushing, obviously, to have norms, because the assembly does set norms, you must continue to get as many people on board on an issue. And what will not work, you don't need to continue to insist it has to work. You move on with other things that are also positive.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so what I'm saying that, so in summary, knowledge is key. Integrity and patience. And obviously you have to have really, in the patience, to have ability to work really long hours. Because really anybody can call you anytime on an issue that they receive from the capital, different time zones that they want you to take on board, or you also want to reach out to others. This is, so you have to really have the strength to continue.
What about character? What about resilience? What about empathy? What about people skills?
This is why I say all the issues relating to factors that will help in leading organizations are there. I didn't want to give a list of these. When you talk of integrity, it connects to character. Empathy connects to listening, because listening is not to listen, but to really listen deeply. This delegation has concerns. These concerns are relevant for them. But even if other delegations see differently, you, how can you now get all this to say, okay, given this, how can we come to the center to make progress in both taking into consideration not at times only two positions, at times several positions at the same time. It's not like two delegations. At times you are pulled in five different directions, but somehow there has to be movement. So all these are connected to the issue of listening and having knowledge and having integrity. These are key. Other elements are important, but I'm just selecting those elements out of several in relation to this organization. In some organizations, some other factors may come tops, even if others are also there.
A former U.S. First Lady, Michelle Obama, has said for the record that becoming a president does not change you, rather it reveals you. How do you react to that?
Well, it is largely true, but it also should leave space for learning. People can do course correction. It's not so often, but it reveals people fundamentally in the way she said it, in that it is something that becomes clear what resources you have to deal with issues for the moment. It's not now that you must know, when you are president, how countries view the world. You don't come to this job to learn anew, but you have deeper insight over the depth of that. So both elements, it reveals you, but you also come to the job hoping and eager to learn, because what then is the point if you go to a position and you don't learn from it? So.
And what have you in fact learned during your presidency? Very briefly, if you could, please.
Well, I think I've learned that things don't change too often, too quickly. I've learned also that with a bit of push, you can get delegations to yield a little fairness many times. But there are some things that you just have to have a bit more hope that not long after you leave, it will change for the better. Certainly, there is a worry concerning, because you talked about the moment we are on to 75th anniversary of the United Nations. I see two trends. One, a lot of delegations realize the importance of the journey 75 years on. the organization is still there. But a lot also must be said for its refusal to change relating to power relations. And I obviously must also for myself worry over questions concerning major powers disagreeing. It has huge implications for the work of the United Nations. We are not to the point of that nothing works, but we must worry to get people to recommit to the principles and values of the organization in such a way that what it has achieved in getting us out of war, in getting us to have strong commitment to rights and respect for others is different. Certainly, these are important.
So if I understood you correctly, do you agree with some critics who have suggested that the United Nations, as it is currently structured, yes, has done a very good job to keep the globe secure and to some degree, also you could say, to sustain peace, but that the institution probably needs really to reform so as to reflect the current social, cultural, political, and economic realities.
Yeah, there is no question. I've said so before, and a lot of colleagues from all parts of the world have said so. The real task is really to get this done. No one can justify lack of change in power relations. We obviously want a United Nations, all of the main organs, we want them to work for all the people. And any sense of exclusion that cannot be justified, I think, takes away to that degree from its legitimacy. This is a general principle, and I think I do not make a criticism lightly of this because I believe in this organization. It has done a lot of good, and it has a lot to do still, a lot more good, but some of the elements of reform need to be hastened. Reform is continuing, but we have to put our focus on useful reforms because the legitimacy of the organization is very important.
If I may be selfish as an African, there are a lot of African commentators who have suggested that Africa needs a veto. It needs a country or countries at least that can actually have veto power. If that cannot happen, what about the option of having, for example, the United Nations General Assembly having the power, for example, to override a veto cast by a permanent member of the UN Security Council?
Well, discussions around the veto have been on for a long time, along with the discussion around the question of reform of the Security Council. What you have stated is the African position, the first part of your statement. For Africa, the story is clear. The sentiment on the continent from the leadership is not for the veto, but that if the veto should continue, then Africa must also exercise it. What eventually will happen will not happen because of the position of any one country. It is something that must be agreed to by all. The difficulty, obviously, is the following. Whatever is agreed to relating to the change in the nature of the Council in terms of the elements of number of countries, who is represented, what power they will or not exercise, must also be signed on to by each of the five current members. So the obviously you can question whether this is fair, but I'm just telling you this is what is there. Now what will happen to get this to happen? And if that should not happen, to now give that kind of power to the General Assembly would require something else. So this is the difficulty. It is our view that ultimately the pressure is mounting. It is not going to continue to be left to those whose power to keep defining this. And the pressure is going to continue to mount, not only in countries of the African region, but in all countries of the world, because the major push in the world today is that of justice and equality. And it is within that context that such a movement is likely to occur. And so the continued discussion and looking at means of getting this to be done, what you said is one option. It's not something that is, as far as I know, seriously under review or under discussion. Many others may be there relating to, of course, the French and the Mexican approach to have a means of limiting the veto through voluntary effort. These things are all among several things being discussed. But again, we are still in the informal section of this conversation in the Assembly and for the last 10 years.
I see. Well, there is a saying that justice delayed is in fact justice denied. What do you say to that?
Certainly, from the point of view of those who are, for want of a better word, subjects of oppression or exclusion, any day is a day that should not have to happen. And from that point of view, delay of reform in relation in the direction of social justice or inclusion, I think, doesn't help anyone.
Mr. President, let's talk about the elephant in the room, and that is COVID-19 pandemic. How has that affected you during your presidency?
Well, the elephant in the room is an elephant all over the world. It has affected everyone everywhere, for most part, for the worse. What it has done is to force us to find creative means of continuing to work, because our approach has been the organization is set up to solve problems of global nature. And therefore, when there's a global problem, we just have to continue to work. But we must obviously, like all others, work conscious of our own safety. So the United Nations more broadly, but the General Assembly in particular, continued to work mainly virtually, even though my office continued to work in a reduced number, but we come to work, we consult when we have to, but we are in touch with the membership. We have been able, over the period from 15, when we couldn't be going to meet like we used to have a mechanism by which we did take decisions, including having elections for the Security Council and for ECOSOC and for the presidency of the Assembly. So we have really gotten the cooperation of others, but it was extremely difficult. It obviously is not the means of doing diplomacy or negotiations. Some negotiations couldn't be taken through Zoom or WebEx or what have you. And therefore, that made it difficult for us to make progress on those areas. Now, let us be clear, even before COVID, most countries, well, maybe not, but perhaps a vast number of the membership was not on target to achieve the sustainable development goals. There were financing challenges. And now this COVID has come. It has put us really back to the drawing board with a renewed commitment to still achieve. But this can only be achieved through enhanced partnerships and some creativity. This is where we are at the moment.
Time is not our best ally. We shall go for a break, and when we come back, we shall continue with the conversation.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Mudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa. And today, it's a candid conversation with Tijan Muhammad Bande, the president of the 74th session of the United Nations General Assembly. You talked about how your office has been functioning largely virtually. The last time I checked, it's about time for you to hand over the baton. The person that is succeeding you will be heading the 75th session of the UNGA. How do you plan to hand over? Are you going to hand over virtually, or is there going to be some sort of special UNGA session in New York?
Well, the handover will be done in person with reduced presence of people. As we have always followed medical guidance. New York is beginning to open. The number of people allowed into the United Nations headquarters has increased. And within these parameters, we will have a physical handover. We'll have a meeting in the assembly where we hand over. And the General Assembly opening itself will be done through a mix of, it's a hybrid form. Some delegations will have space to come in, one or two per delegation, while others and some of the speeches will be given through taped messages. So it is the beginning of our opening, looking at the parameter of health, but also trying to begin to navigate how to come back in safety, but to come back to work in person. So the General Assembly at its opening in a few weeks' time will be a hybrid one. The President of the Assembly, the Secretary General, representatives, be they from capital or based in New York, will sit behind their desks. This is the pattern that is agreed to. And I will hand over on the 15th of this month, and it will be done in the assembly. Before then, on the 3rd and the 4th, we'll have a meeting of the assembly in the hall. Reduced number of people will be in the United Nations headquarters, and will take stock of the decisions taken under silence procedure, which allowed us to have the resolutions and the decisions. We formalize this and do some other things that need to be done. We are likely to have meetings on the 3rd and the 4th, maybe on the 8th and 11th. And then on the 15th, we will have formal handover and takeover from the 74th to the 75th. And then the session opens and life continues.
And will you be, for example, observing the science? Will you be, for example, donning masks? And what about social distancing?
These are the protocols that we have always complied with. And that's why it will be reduced number. And of course, people will come in masks. There will be social distancing. And these things are already marked. So that is what we are saying. We will abide by the rules as they evolve. And whatever the rules would be on the 15th, according to medical guidance, is what we would do.
Any update on the apparent conflict pitting the Trump administration and the World Health Organization and China?
Well, this really is not for the assembly. I think for us, the position of the General Assembly is that we do need to work together. We have to work together on a global problem, and a pandemic is really an example par excellence of the need for us to do so. And our approach is to continue to urge partnerships to solve global problems. And the pandemic is one such matter that we continue to urge collaboration. The World Health Organization will continue its work, and the Assembly will continue its resolutions urging countries to work together.
You know, as well as I do, that if there is any single lesson that the pandemic has taught us, the entire world, is that we should learn pretty fast to realize that we are one human family, because this coronavirus, the last time I checked, seems to be an equal opportunity employer. It does not discriminate. It does not discriminate in terms of social, economic, political status. It has absolutely no respect for borders or boundaries, race or ethnicity or religion. Is there a chance that the world as a human family can pretty soon to learn to reflect what the virus has taught us, because it has pretty much made it clear that we need to be each other's keepers, that we need to hold each other's backs if we are to survive? Could this type of dynamic, for example, be reflected in a new United Nations architecture, reflected, for example, in the composition of the UN Security Council?
Well, I think two things. Just to say this, that the pandemic is only a reminder. It's not the first time we have known our connections as humanity. Why was the United Nations itself created? Because it understood the connections of peace and war, and the dangers of a go-it-alone approach in terms of stability in the world. So nuclear weapons, for example, climate action, these things have, we have known them, but this has been a very rude reminder of the truth of what you have stated. Now, the United Nations, to the extent it will have a Security Council with single vetoes, will continue to create problems in the notion of justice and equality. The Security Council is created to make it easier and less interest. And that's why that heavy responsibility, because it's a responsibility given to the membership, I think that this is discharged. And so certainly any long delay, as you've stated earlier, creates a problem. But obviously the world has learned. One, the notion is clear. And in the United Nations, relating for whatever principal organ you talk to, people appreciate that well. In relation to the pandemic, it's very clear. Any one country that is left behind will mean no one is safe. And just imagine 6 months ago, 7 months ago, we were talking about this. And today, in every country, rich or poor, this is the situation. But then you also raise an issue that we need to also talk about, because this is important for me, for the presidency, where we privilege poverty eradication and zero hunger and education and inclusion as key concerns of the presidency. You see, even in countries that are more privileged than others or related to the rest of the membership, there are differences in terms of who is affected, what demographic groups are most affected, even if it affects everyone. But the sociology of the matter is very clear. It affects the poor the most. How do you social distance in relation to, or who is able to call for food if there is no saving?
How do you access hygiene, for example, when you talk about water?
Yeah, in slum. So that's why the whole issue is that it's not even an issue of rich or poor countries. It is also an issue of inequality within countries, which also must be addressed. So we talk about the big question. We also talk about the small questions that will tell you that we do have a lot to do, a lot of work ahead of us. Within countries, whether the countries are rich or poor, we must ask the question of social justice, of inclusion, of poverty eradication.
Now, Mr. President, the last time you and I interacted on this platform was last year.
Indeed.
And when we interacted, you heard what you characterized as very important. You had an agenda. You had an important set of priorities. And of course, at the time we talked, no one could have thought or realized that we are just about to enter into a world dominated by COVID-19. Despite the COVID-19 pandemic, what have you been able, out of those priorities, what have you been able to accomplish or to deliver?
Well, I think we have been able to deliver on all the elements, because what we wanted to do was to raise the attention of the world and of those who are able to make a difference relating to the urgency of those issues. Let me also remind that to make sure that we didn't invent the wheel, we actually crafted our vision around already agreed to SDGs. Poverty eradication is goal number one, which tells you its critical importance. And education, inclusion, climate action. And so we have continued before the pandemic we celebrated on January 24th, International Day of Education, wherein we brought people to talk about the critical importance of education in terms of partnership, in terms of learning, in terms of what it means to the world. We continued to deal with poverty issues throughout the period, from both before the pandemic and during the pandemic. And during the pandemic, the connections among poverty and education also became clear, and exclusion. We talk about today, I'm located in the United Nations in New York, and the debate is to how do we safely go back to school. We have options of online learning or a hybrid element. In many parts of the world, this option is hardly there.
It's not available.
Because, yeah, of course, so you see, again,
because of the digital divide.
Of course. So you can now see, this has brought us to see that, well, in any reform of education now, going forward, the issue of technology is not a secondary matter for all parts of the world.
What would you say if you were to put your fingers on it, that this is the single most important decision that I have been able to make during my presidency? And what about the single most regrettable decision during the same period?
We have learned the fundamental connections between human beings, and the health element just brought it very forcefully into view. At the same time, we have also seen the effort of governments, NGOs, and others to show empathy to others, even when at times some governments are dealing less empathically with the issues. This is the nature of the world. So both, and this is not about any single country, it's just the issue that we have seen non-governmental organizations, we have seen governments, we have seen institutions trying to say, let's move together to address this matter. And to also make the claim, and this is what is beautiful, that post the pandemic, we need to build back better for resilience. This is one other element in the conversation that is important. Resilience after. This is important. So I obviously had wished there was more active demonstration by some of the big powers of empathy, but I also take the view that many countries, both bilaterally and also in giving support to the United Nations to support efforts around the world, I think have shown that human beings have deep connections.
What about the issue of the fight against terrorism? In your particular case from Nigeria and West Africa, I am talking, of course, about Boko Haram. And in East Africa, I am talking about Al-Shabaab.
Yes, I think what it does is that terrorism is not something that any country is innocent about. The reasons for terror will vary, but it is something that each political system has seen. And recognition has been very clear now that we have to cooperate, because in several respects, terror groups either learn from each other or connect to each other. And there is necessity, therefore, to continue to sharpen our tools as a global community to deal with terror in several ways. One, dealing with the drivers of exclusion, and two, cutting funding for terror groups, and three, mitigation, giving support to victims. Many elements are important in dealing with terror. And the recognition is very clear. For the United Nations, there is a whole Undersecretary General whose work is really focused on countering terrorism. This is a very important work, and some countries have given support in training and whether bilaterally or through organizations. And so terror is one element that reminds, sadly, of our connections and the necessity to work together in training and in sharing of information and in whatever methods are needed to give us more safety.
If I heard you correctly, Mr. President, are you in agreement with some critics who say part of the reason that the war against terrorism has not really been won up to now is probably because the emphasis has been focused on essentially fighting the symptoms as opposed to looking for and in fact dealing with the fundamental root causes?
Looking at the perhaps historiography of the matter, in the earlier stages, that criticism would have carried more truth. But in the last decade, I think better understanding of the need to put all the elements, I think has been common. In the United Nations, for example, conflict is seen through a lot of places, and it is the same with terror. I think there is more understanding of doing many things to avoid conflict, to bring inclusion, and to deal with root causes. Of course, the more public aspect of it is about guns and boots and stuff like that. But the whole question of reforming educational system is a bit tame. You don't see it that often. Getting employment up, reforming the curriculum, and stuff like that. I think those ones are also going, many countries are more sensitive to this, but it's not as much publicized as the idea of going after individuals or groups that are housed in spaces and stuff like that. But all are important. But I think what I'm saying, what you are saying is true. We have focused in the past more on this military type thing, but I think there's better understanding of the need to take on board many things, including rehabilitating those caught in the as young people in that kind of ideological stuff and stuff like that.
Let's look at the report card and give you an opportunity to make a self-assessment of your presidency. On the scale of 0 to 10, 10 being the highest and 1 being the lowest, how do you see yourself scoring?
Unfortunately, I'm not in a position to do that assessment. I think I leave that one to others to do. Live with the satisfaction that at every time we weren't lazy as an office. We gave it our all. We listened. We tried to be positive. That's all I can say. Our team has worked assiduously with all partners, especially within the UN system, and with the support of not only member states, but particular member states giving also support. I think we leave it at this.
I know, of course, that you will not be the captain of the celebrations of the 75 years of the existence of the United Nations. That honor goes to the individual who is about to succeed you. But briefly, could you share with us some of the expected highlights?
I take pleasure in knowing that I negotiated the document which heads of state and government will sign on to, the document concerning the declaration of the 75th anniversary. It's a very important responsibility. And there's a strong continuity between what the 74th session is doing or have done with the current or the emerging leadership. He is focusing initially on the SDG, but also continuing from what others have started. But he's focusing on post-COVID, dealing with COVID. I think this is a very wise approach, you know, from the next PGA. We'll all accompany him on this. Obviously, there will be an endorsement of the document by heads of state and government. There will be a plenary involving youth because it is about them. And these are the main issues.
Mr. President, with this platform of Straight Talk Africa, you have unfettered access to millions of homes in Africa. What is it that you would tell the audience that the United Nations remains very relevant to them?
Africa is relevant to the world. Let's start with that one. I cannot see a world at peace or upholding rights and development that is not also the same for Africa. And therefore, Africa is relevant to the world. It contributes to the world in terms of the conversations that need to happen. The world is also relevant to Africa. And Africa should continue with confidence about itself, relate to the world, state what it needs and what its contributions can be. And we go there with a sense of equality for all and no priority to any group. Africa is 54 members of the United Nations. It is very easily one quarter of the house, and therefore it should go and has gone to the world body with this confidence. And the effort of African permanent representatives, very, very serious-minded, hard-working individuals, has always been supported by the effort of the African Union to continue to harmonize its position concerning peace and development, security and rights on the continent. And I think African citizens should continue to relate to the world in the same spirit.
Thank you so much. And I thank you from the deepest, better part of the bottom of my Kavali heart and soul.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to have this conversation.
Our distinguished guest is Tijan Muhammad Bande. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please, please, remember to keep the African hopes alive.